The pharmaceutical industry is a complex and fascinating field. It takes countless of people to bring a high-quality product to the market. In the Qualitox podcast, I bring to you leaders, experts, and innovators who will share their experiences and explain to us how they do it. Welcome to the Qualitox podcast. I'm Ian Kugler, your host, and my guest today is Alex Hall. Alex is a qualified person, and she used to be a QP assessor for the Royal Society of Chemistry in the United Kingdom. And right now she's training QPs, and she's also an independent consultant. And today we're going to talk to her about risk management. So let's get to it. Alex, hi, welcome back to the Qualitox podcast. It's a pleasure as always.
Hi, Jan. Lovely to see you again.
I think that we should pick up where we stopped last time with risk management.
Yep.
And we talked last time about how pharma can learn from other industries and what can be better and why we should be more proactive. And I think that it would be a great idea to get now a bit into tools, what we can use for harnessing this risk management, and what is the best way to use those tools, and so on. But before that, let's maybe talk about a bit about ICH9. So we talked about it a bit before, and we said that it gives some guidance. But it just say, okay, you should do this, this, and this, but it doesn't go into details how to do it. It should be science-backed, and it should be well-documented. So from your point of view, what is not being done correctly? Do you think that people really follow all of this?
I really don't think that people understand that the basics of ICHQ9 will give you a really good skeleton on which to build your quality risk management system. They tend to focus, and I think we mentioned this last time, Jan, on the quality risk analysis and the impact analysis, and forget everything else that comes around it. So if we actually look at the famous diagram in ICHQ9, we really do need to be thinking about initiating a risk management process. That's the first part, and nobody does it. And it absolutely blows my mind, because remember what we were saying last time, real pure quality risk management is proactive, which means that you should set up a program of which systems and processes are you actually going to look at proactively to determine where your risk lies. You should also make sure that it's inbuilt into your things like change control and new product and process introduction. And then from there, the first part of ICHQ9 has a box called risk assessment. And that risk assessment actually has three elements in it. And we only ever look at the risk analysis part. We don't look at the risk identification, which is that proactive piece where we use all of our wonderful tools. And those tools we get hung up on because some of them can be really complex, very labor intensive, very time consuming. Then we analyze the risk that comes out of there. And there's a big assumption that risk analysis is the whole part of this. But actually, risk analysis is taking the output from our risk identification, from our FMEA or fault tree analysis, or whatever tool we've used, and then say, well, actually, how risky is this? And we evaluate that risk. We give it a number, we give it a severity, high, low, or medium, and then we move on from that to the next box in ICHQ9, which is our risk control. And there's another mistake people make. Risk control. We can accept risks. We are all overworked in quality. Yeah, every quality professional I know who works in the pharmaceutical industry is overworked. And part of that is that we spend our lives firefighting. If we were actually true preventative quality assurance professionals, we would be doing things to stop things going wrong, and we wouldn't be firefighting things that have already gone wrong. And risk management is the gateway to being proper quality assurance professionals. So if we look at the risk control part, yes, if we've identified something that's high risk, we need to do something about it. And again, I'm going to go back to our health and safety colleagues who have this wonderful term, which is bring the risk as low as reasonably practicable. I love that term, because what you'll find is that because so many of our colleagues in the pharma industry are not appropriately trained in risk management, they misunderstand, I've identified a risk, I've got to do something about it. Yep, I've got to throw lots of money and lots of resource at it. And either they don't understand the true measure of that risk, they're looking at it from a silo mentality. So in the laboratory, they've got to spend lots and lots of money on new HPLCs because their HPLC might be 0.001% out. How important is that against the whole risk profile of the company? Now, it may be really important depending on what you're looking at. Or it may be that actually we've got something else going on and we need to spend our resource there. Or it may be that something is actually never ever going to happen. So we look at the probability piece, and it might happen once in 100 years. Now, that doesn't mean, we've already mentioned this, that it's not going to happen tomorrow, but we can kind of say the amount of money we're going to spend on that is prohibitive. We're going to bring it as low as reasonably practicable. But if there really isn't anything we can do about it, we can actually say we are going to accept that risk. Now, what you said before was documenting everything. And that's another mistake people make. Yes, I'm going to accept the risk. And that's all they say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the document, it just says risk accepted. I really want to see why they've made that decision, because it might be perfectly reasonable. Yeah, it's a great idea to accept the risk, but why have you done that? What factors have you taken into account? Yeah.
So I've seen it many times that people look at some deviations, for example, at release of a raw material or packaging material. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there is some deviation that is categorized as minor, for example, like electrical resistance or something like this. And then they give it to some specialist, and he alone signs it up. It's okay. There is no problem with it, for example. Yeah. And but there is never, there is many times that they give it to one specialist instead of giving it to a team of some expert with other points of view, because it's the same person that always signs it up and says, for me, it's not a risk.
Yeah.
But then again, we just lose the point of the whole risk management that should be done within a team.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's the different points of view that will help us understand the magnitude of risk, the possibility of risk, and also the risk appetite. Because different people have different appetites for risk. And it is, again, about making sure that it's all documented. One of the key things that I do when I'm working in pharma is, lots of people will say to me, Alex, we can actually get this batch passed, or we can get this test approved, and it's fine. And I ask them to tell me why it's fine. And they can talk to me for half an hour. Very often that half an hour chat is not written in the documentation. So I'll say to them, okay, write that all down for me. And as soon as they start writing and trying to actually justify in written words why it's okay, they can't actually find the right words. And then they come back to me and they say, actually the risk of this might be a little bit higher than I initially said, because when I started looking at this part, something else occurred to me. So writing things down isn't just good practice from a regulatory perspective that we've got a record. It actually helps the thinking process. So when we've got our group of people around, making sure that it's all written down is really important. And then putting that into a cohesive rationale is also really important.
Right. So you mentioned at the beginning that it is crucial at first to do the risk identification.
Yes.
Right? So what tool would you use? What tool do you love to use for this purpose?
Well, risk identification, lots of people in pharma think that risk is identified only through incidents and issues and deviations happening. That is incorrect. If you wait until then, you're too late. It's already happened. The horse is already out of the stable, as it were. Now, there is a wonderful PICS guideline that expands on the ICHQ9, and that gives you some hints and tips of what to do and where you can get your risk identification from. So my advice here is change control. I had a young lady talk to me just this week about the issue of planned deviations. Now, planned deviations don't exist. It's always a temporary change. And that's because when we look at change control, we look at risk management as part of a change control. So change control is always one of those things where we must look at risks in advance, proactively. New product introduction. We should always look at risk management as part of new product introduction. And that should be risk to that product coming into our facility and risks to current products in our facility. And then it just mushrooms out into utilities, facilities, equipment, personnel, even the environmental impact of a new product coming in. So it can be huge. And then you can have individual risk management activities. And one of the ways that what you can have is you can have an explosion of just busy work. Try and avoid just extra busy work, because it looks like, I've got document checks and I've got audits and I've got internal audits and I've got self-inspections, and now I've got to do quality risk management as well as a standalone activity, where I take a system and I look at what could potentially go wrong when I'm already firefighting everything that's already gone wrong. What I tend to do is I would incorporate your quality risk management into your internal audit schedule, because then you're hitting two birds with one stone. And you take a system, a process, a product, and you basically map it out on the wall with your group of people who are either experts in the system because they know what's actually happening, or naive to the process because they can question what's happening and say, where could this possibly go wrong?
You just sit together and just do a brainstorm for everything that can happen.
Absolutely. That is the simplest way to do your quality risk management activity. It's simple. It's straightforward. Everybody knows how to do it. You can document it in a really straightforward way, and it works. One of the things that people have asked me about brainstorming is, how do we document such an activity in a way that conforms to data integrity? That's relatively straightforward. You've got lots of post-it notes, you've got flip charts, you've got all sorts of things. You can use photographic evidence of that kind of output and bring that into your media storage. Of course, you have to make sure that that is documented and annotated appropriately, so that you've got an audit trail of who was there and when it was done. But you want to have the freedom to express yourself in the way that works well, and you want to make sure that you're maintaining data integrity. So these things all add up, they all tie together and overlap.
Exactly. So it's really simple to document it in an effect. And I think maybe because of that, people maybe don't do it too much in GP, because I think in pharma we lost a bit of the agile way, because everything, and we forgot how it was in university and school. You just sit and you brainstorm, so you can just, as you said, just photograph it and then print it, let people sign it, or just copy it in a document. Mm-hmm. So there are many ways to do it, but just do it in a team. And I think that it's something that sometimes eludes some people, because I've seen it several times that people do risk analysis all by themselves. And I think it's the biggest mistake that a person can do, and in the end it brings nothing, because if you do it alone, you sign it off, you miss stuff. You're also routine blinded, because especially if you do a risk analysis for your own process, so you just write it down as you want it to be and as you wish it to be, and with as much little problem, so you just want it to be signed off as quickly as possible.
Guilty of doing that myself, Jan. But usually when I join a new company, I will try and do some quality risk management activities, which helps me get to know the systems. So at least I don't have the issue of being too close to the process, which does help. But often there is limited resource for people to do quality risk management. And what I'd really like to see senior management do is to understand that the more resource we put in for proactive risk management, the less resource we will need for firefighting. So it'd be great if we could change that dynamic over.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And people also need to understand that when you do risk management, doesn't mean that every problem that you find must be solved. So you mentioned as low as possibly practicable, and it's a great term, and I believe it came from the United Kingdoms and for work safety.
Yes, regulations. It's for health and safety, yes.
And I don't think it's used all over the world, but I think it's been implemented in many industries, also in medical devices and so on. And it's a great approach also if you use it additionally to your FMEA and with your scoring system. So if you establish a middle area and you say, okay, everything that falls between those scores, we must, so it's not critical, it's not low, but we need to look at it and then decide if the resources are fit and should we allocate resource or the resources for it or not.
Okay.
And I'm not sure that it's been used everywhere.
No, because people tend not to have the knowledge of it and the understanding of it. So it's really important that when people are doing risk management activities, that they are trained in the process. Because you wouldn't take up a chainsaw and try and chop down a forest without being trained in chainsaw safety. Yeah, when you go and hire one of these big chainsaws at an equipment hire place, they actually make you go through some safety training because they are dangerous tools. And risk management tools, apart from the brainstorming that we've just talked about, actually do need a bit of training to be able to work them and to use them properly. So when we're talking about, you spoke about FMEA just there. So failure mode risk analysis is one of the more complex tools that you will be using when you're doing a risk management activity. And it is really important to understand both the usefulness of it and how it can leave you a little bit confused and give you, what's the word I'm trying to think of? FMEA can be very unwieldy. It can cause you problems when you're trying to manage your risk management. So the first step in any risk management, always try and map your process, because that will hopefully give you real clarity on what your actual process is as it's being used. It may not match what's in your procedures. That's something you do need to understand, that your procedure may not be correct. So there's one of your first risks that you've already identified. Once you've mapped your process, you will start delving into all sorts of things, and you can use additional quality tools like your fishbone diagrams and your five whys, but those are adjuncts to your FMEA, your failure modes effects analysis. And the outcome from failure modes effects analysis tends to be a numbered scoring system. When you use a numbered scoring system, there are some pitfalls, generally due to human beings. Human beings love numbers. We love to have is it a four? Is it a five? Is it a four and a half? I always say to people, it doesn't matter. As long as you put a number down, we can sort out any differences at the end of the day.
I think you're completely right that people, when they take the FMEA, they shouldn't just take some generic template from the internet because it was initially not designed for pharma. It was designed for military use. And the values there are not pharma specific. So when you take the FMEA, sit together with your team and think about your processes and where it your numbers can fit. So you don't have to take the standard 1 to 10. I've seen people that take one. I've been to an audit in one company and they use 1 to 100.
Yeah. That's a little overboard, and probably.
It was crazy because you ask, okay, what's the difference between those? And they, why did you, how did you reason those numbers? And they have no idea because they just use it. And then you sit there and as you said, is it a 7? No, it's an 8. And then you debate 1 hour, 7 or 8. So in effect, if it fits your processes, you can take 1 to 3, just minor, major, critical, do it 1 to 3 and then decide when you multiply them, what do you do in each area? So it doesn't have to be 1 to 10, it can be 1 to 5, it can be 1 to 3, just so I think that's the basics. So at first, know the process and then design the FMEA according to your processes, according to the statistics. So if you have only, I don't know, 2 batches per year because it's some biotechnological long process, you wouldn't use the same numbers maybe that you would use when you have 1,000 batches or something like this because you don't have the statistics, especially with a new process. So just really sit down and think about the numbers that so you can assign what activities you do. Because if you just use numbers, you cannot really assign the activities and what you should take away from this this activity.
There's a real problem with numbers in FMEA. And part of that is that if you don't rationalize your numbering system across all your different systems that are going to be using FMEA, then your risk register actually becomes very difficult because what you want to be doing is to put high risks onto a risk register so that your senior management have a really good overview of what activities need to be taking place, what activities are not being acted upon, for example. And of course, if you have different numbering systems across different processes, then it's very, very difficult to align those in one spreadsheet. So you have to keep all of this in mind. As I said, being trained in risk management is so critical to being able to manage this system. So if we hang up on numbers, then you are worried about having a 5 or a 6, and eventually it really doesn't matter. And when you think about having different numbering systems for different parts of your quality system, you do have to be aware of the impact that that's going to have on your overall risk register, because the risk register is how we communicate with our senior managers on the level of risk that is for the whole company. And if we have different scoring systems throughout different levels of the company, different systems, then we need one way to say What is it for the overarching process? So you might be translating that into high, medium and low overall, or having one system of scoring. What I found is that it is really, really difficult to do that, however.
Do you have some maybe advice how should companies go about it, and how should they design their scoring system?
Well, what we said in the last discussion, Jan, was that you really do need to have an overseeing committee and somebody who is on the senior management team who is responsible for the quality risk management. And I would suggest that that team make sure that they have full oversight of whatever is going on for each of the systems for quality risk management and make sure that there is some consistency in place.
Exactly. So in the end, every scoring system could work. It's just important that it's consistent and people understand what's behind it.
Yeah, because if one department classes something as critical, but it's not actually critical to the business as a whole, it can throw off all the resource allocation for that business. And it could stop something that is really critical to the business happening in another area.
Mm-hmm. So that's why all people who do risk analysis really need to be well trained to really distinguish the criticality, and so it's not just. So they don't just understand it how it's done in their department. They should understand it how it's generally should be done in if the risk is in for each department. So it should be the same understanding at least in the company.
Yeah, absolutely. So for small companies, it's actually quite good to have everybody trained up and everybody understanding, because most people in a small company will understand the whole process and everything that's happening. But in larger companies, and particularly those that are multinational, it would be really good to have key people trained in facilitation of things like FMEA processes, so that they can sit in and guide people and say, well, this is happening in your area, but please don't forget that this also happens somewhere else, or this impacts on this other system, so that they can have oversight of the entire process flow.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And from my perspective, so when people sit and do the FMEA or any risk assessment, so my personal advice, don't bring people from the same don't bring all the people from the same department. For example, if you are doing an FMEA or risk analysis and impact analysis on because of some deviation, so don't put five people from the same quality control lab. Take one person from there, and then take another from quality assurance. Take somebody else from R&D, from PAT lab. Take somebody from a different QC department. So as many as points of view, because if you take people from the same department, they would have the same training, the same point of view, and they probably see the mistakes the same way because they have the same routine. So just mix it up.
Absolutely. I mean, I have a little story where risk assessment and risk management went wrong. A proactive risk assessment was done on bringing in a product into a facility. The facility was a secondary packaging facility, and the work that came in was a simple repackaging of a bottle. Okay. And the risk assessment was done, the bottles weren't going to be opened, and the product was considered safe to bring in and be repackaged into this facility. All we were going to do was change the label on the bottle. We didn't get the right people in the room. We found that out later when the packaging guys said, there's some orange powder on the bottles. Oh. One of the key questions that we had to ask was, what's inside the bottles? And yes, it was orange powder that was inside the bottles, which was also penicillin. That hadn't been considered as a factor in our assessment. So we actually were not working in a penicillin safe area, and the factory had to shut down for a week while it was cleaned and everybody had to go home.
Okay, that's an interesting story, and it all could have been avoided if the right people were sitting at the table.
Absolutely. So you can see the benefit of proper risk management. If we'd just had the one person at the table who'd said, what if? Very unlikely that these bottles would have leaked. Yeah, there was an induction seal on the bottle. Unfortunately, it failed. You know, really, really unlikely. But if we put the safety precautions in place in the first place, which would have been relatively cheap and simple, we wouldn't have had a week of production downtime, which was really expensive.
Of course. And that's why you have the risk analysis in the first place, right? Invest a bit of time to prevent great money loss or great risk. So that is a great example why you should do it, and you should do it right.
Yes.
Because if you just sit there just to show the auditor that you did it, you're fooling yourself, and it's a shame.
Yeah, it should never be a tick box exercise. It should always be done absolutely properly and always be documented properly too.
Yeah. And Alex, so we mentioned at the beginning the as low as possibly practicable, and we said that not everybody uses it. And so let's say ALARP from now.
ALARP, yes. ALARP.
Just to make it a bit shorter. So do you have some example for an ALARP and how you would go about it?
Okay, so when we're looking at as low as reasonably practical, what we're looking for here is if we have a issue where we believe there might be a risk, but the measures that we would take to put to completely reduce that risk to zero are prohibitively expensive or would take an enormous amount of time. So if we look at the COVID-19 situation, for example, that's a really good example where people in the pharmaceutical industry need to go to work. Yeah. Ideally, you would not have people in pharmaceutical factories because that's a high risk of them contracting COVID and for them transmitting COVID. However, people need their medicines. So there's another high risk of people not being treated for their conditions. So what you do there is you institute the measures of social distancing, providing people with masks, producing the medicines that are needed the most, taking away medicines that, okay, they're lifestyle medicines, for example, things that people are not relying on to survive and to reduce really serious symptoms. And so what you're doing is you are reducing the risk of transmission of that disease to as low as reasonably practicable. Pharmaceutical companies have not shut down over this period of time, even if there is a small risk of transmission of that disease. So that is a really good example of ALARP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've read about some also interesting examples from general environmental example that, for example, an acceptable risk would be getting hit by lightning.
Yes.
Right? So you know it's there, but it's critical, but you wouldn't go around with some antenna or some protection around it. It's not possible. But another measurable risk that you, for example, when you drive a car, you know it's dangerous, but you take the precautions and you invest, because you know that if you invest a bit of money in a seatbelt, it would do a lot of good, but against a lightning strike, you cannot do much. So I think it was quite a nice example there.
Yeah, and another example that I've heard, but I don't know how true it is, was the Fukushima disaster. So they know that that part of Japan is liable to earthquakes, and they predicted that there was very likely to be a tsunami in that area. And they had a protective wall built, and they calculated, I don't know how they do these calculations, but they calculated that once in 100 years they were going to get a wave of such a height, and once in 1,000 years they were going to get a wave of much bigger. But the wall to protect them from the 1,000-year wave would have been just so expensive that they went for the 100-year wall height. Of course, it was the 1,000-year wave that hit them, because we said this before, just because it's a 1,000-year wave doesn't mean it's not going to go
Exactly.
to come tomorrow. So that is one example where, unfortunately, the risk didn't pay off, the gamble, as it were.
It's a really interesting thought about it. So you can also choose to do something about it, but you can just invest a little money or do a little effort. So, like, the 20-80 rule. So do the
Yes.
20 per, per invest the 20% effort for 80% efficiency or result, but there's still there is
There's
something.
still a risk. It is actually gambling.
Most important part is really to take the proactive approach and think about what could happen, not just go around with the reactive approach when you have the deviations. So really do it routinely. And do you find that people do it routinely enough?
Simple answer. Oh,
So
I find that there is a real resistance still today in the majority of companies to institute a routine process where we just do, let's look at the system, let's see where it can go wrong, let's put some continuous improvement measures in place. People wait for it to go wrong and then do something.
And but do you think it's going to change with the digitalization?
I hope so.
Because I had a really good talk about it in a podcast with Doron Sidbon. He is a CEO of Dot Compliance, and it's a quality management system. And we talked about it. How in the future the quality assurance would be basically data analysts. And this is the future. It's somebody who sits and evaluates the data because the data is so approachable and so easy, and the computer does most of it for you, the analysis, the data. And I think maybe people don't do it enough because all the data is so manual for the batch. So many companies probably don't have electronic batch records or some really good EQMS in place. So they really have to dig up all the deviations or the manual change control. But if everything is in the system, just do the trend analysis, take out the information, and just review it. And then it's much quicker. Also, look at the past and correct the future.
You're going to get me started here, Jan, because
Oh,
I have a slight issue with deviations and
no.
change
Oh, okay.
controls. Garbage in, garbage out.
Okay.
As a
What do you mean by
QE,
that?
I need that information and I need it to be correct. I need it to be searchable. I need to be able to make decisions on that data, and it's particularly on the trend data. What I don't get is people putting the data in a standardized way so that I can actually search it and find what I need. A really good example of a deviation or a change control that would be the bane of a QP's life: a change or deviation on the water system. No one takes the time to put every batch number or every product code into that document of every product or batch that's going through the factory at the time this change is being made and the validation is happening for that activity. Nobody does that. Yet, when I'm certifying a batch, I am legally obliged to take account of any change control or deviation that's happening at the time that batch is being manufactured. How can I possibly do my job properly if the guys who are working on that system are not taking the time to enter that data absolutely as it should be? Yeah. So there needs to be a change in focus with some of these things. And it ties in with what you were saying, is that we need to make sure that all the audit trails match up, not just the ones we can be bothered to fill in.
Yeah, so if it is computerized and you have so for example when you go to sign up in some form online, so you have the star, the red stars, right? So they
Yes.
say, okay, you cannot proceed without filling that in. So it should be exactly like that. So if you, we go away from the paper and then we give the people tablets and there are forms and they're obliged to fill everything up in an exact way, then we are safer. And
Yeah, but in my with my quality risk management head, even with a red star, they'll fill in one batch. They won't fill in every batch.
yeah, so make yeah, but then you have really to. Yeah, but of course you then need the people who review it for I concept and
All right, concept, yeah, but then I'd go back and design in
yeah. So you
a
just need to
timescale
design the
with the
system that
ERP.
way.
Yeah, I'd tie it up with the ERP and I would actually get all those fields automatically filled because the ERP system should know exactly what's going through that factory.
So it should be all harmonized and connected in effect. And this is a this is a, also one of the things that we discuss that many companies have many systems. So they
Yes.
upgrade themselves from paper, then they upgrade it to a system that does only change control. Then it was 20 years ago, and there was still no good system for vendor qualification. So they got vendor qualification. Now they have two systems. Now they have another system for deviations and this, and they don't harmonize. They don't come together.
Oh, don't even get me started on takeovers. Yeah. It's, you work for one company and they've got five different systems, and then you get taken over by another company. But I did work for a company that I calculated had, I think it was seven, it could have been nine different systems for disseminating and recording your training.
This is this is a recipe for disaster. It doesn't
Absolutely.
matter what you have. You have different systems. So I have worked also in a place where they have initially. So there is a gradual change. So you have a initial system for change control. So one site has this one, that one, and then and the problem if so we had we had a tech transfer, and then the people from other side had to familiarize themselves with this, and they needed to copy manually the data to another system. So it's of course chaos and shouldn't be like this. So really the biggest tip, try to harmonize the system, try to stay with one provider. Or so today it's so easy when you also change providers, so easy to extract the data and automatically just popularize the new system. So I think most of the service
Yeah.
providers come with this option.
It's easy to extract the data, it's much more difficult to validate that extraction.
Yeah, well, so you need really to do it carefully and work with good partners for it. But I think the harmonization is the key, because if you have, for example, you do a vendor validation, vendor qualification, then you have some deviations with this vendor, but this system with the qualification doesn't know about those deviations, and
Oh.
you need to do it manually, and you
You see,
forget.
this is where our risk management comes back in, Jan, because I've seen so many companies whose policy it is not to record deviations raised either by or against their vendors
Oh,
in their current systems.
how is that, and how is it smart not to record deviations with vendors?
Exactly. Exactly. They say, oh, it's outside of what we do, so we don't put it into our quality system. We leave it in their quality system. And I'm like, no, how
No,
can you
no.
trend that?
Of course. How can you trend it? How can you assess them? So you need to do yearly assessments. How if you just leave it in, so maybe you have another system for recalls, but who looks at it? It's usually some system that the procurement or the buyers use, and it's not validated, and
So there's a really good place to do quality risk management is your vendor assurance program. Yeah, if you actually mapped the vendor assurance program and put it up on a wall, it would be so complex, so confusing. Different people from many different departments looking at it, different inputs, different outputs, all sorts of complexity. You could easily see where issues could occur, non-conformances could occur, data could fall through the cracks, people could not be told information, and we could be open to problems with patients, problems with the business, problems with compliance, and we could deal with that all in advance rather than waiting for it to go wrong. Yeah. So systems like that are wonderful to be used to as a sort of pilot for a really robust quality risk management process. And it's actually relatively straightforward to do that because you have that expertise, hopefully, in-house. You're not trying to do failure modes effects analysis on a piece of equipment. That should be done when you're buying that piece of equipment. That should be done proactively there. But in the true ICHQ9 program, as part of your quality system, take something like vendor assurance. I would suggest perhaps breaking it into bits because it's going to take you a long time to look at the whole process. Get your team together, get them energized, think about how you're going to benefit the company by streamlining it. Think about your output, what's actually going to happen at the end of this process. How are you going to improve things, speed things up, save money, and prevent non-conformances? Because, of course, that is at our heart what we as quality professionals want. But quality is a business system, and we do also want to make things faster, better, and cheaper for the company.
Exactly. And that this is one part of the risk. Just do it, and then you minimize the cost. So this is a win-win situation. So I think
It takes resource and time up front.
Exactly. So I think we can finalize on those wise words. And Alex, thank you very much as usual for your knowledge, for sharing your experiences, and it's a pleasure as always talking to you.
You're welcome, Jan. Thank you.
Thank you for watching and listening to the QualiTalks podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, consider subscribing and sharing it with others. Stay compliant and see you in the next one.